Welcome everybody. Apologies, slightly small audience, but very pleased to have with us Alexander Noikovits, who is going to talk on a project. He's going to say that as well, but let me say it, on a project, a bigger project, on a couple of papers from a bigger project funded by the government of Serbia. I think on COVID implications and the effects of the lockdowns and everything on COVID. Alexander is a leader, I think, of the project, but as you can tell us, it's a bigger team. They have done a number of recent pieces on that. Alexander is professor of econometrics and time series analysis at the University of Belgrade in the Faculty of Economics, and she's written books and published many articles on both theoretical and applied econometrics. She has been visiting here at the LSE, but also at New York University and also Free University in Berlin. And she's done a lot of work on kind of policy work, if you want, for the World Bank, ILO, European Commission, USAID, and other organizations. As I said, this is my notes say that you're a principal investigator in the special research program on COVID-19, which is financed by the Science Fund of the Republic of Serbia. So I think this event is being recorded, and a version of it will be available as a podcast. So be aware of that. In practice, our practice is that we allow the speaker to do around 45 minutes of a presentation and then have a discussion. I think that it would make sense to deviate a bit from that, so allow any questions that are a bit technical or clarification questions as the presentation goes on, and then I will be conscious of time so as to allow a bit of a discussion. And feedback, I guess, also towards the end. If you're tweeting, is anybody tweeting here? The hashtag is hashtag LSE COVID-19, 19 a number and all one word. It's probably behind, it's not behind me. Yeah, and that's it. So very pleased, let me say again, to have Alexander here. We have a long, over many years, collaboration, both as individuals, but institutionally also with the Faculty of Economics at the University of Belgrade. And it's good to be back, you know, hopefully without COVID, and have these events in person and be able to interact a bit more. Okay, I'll stop here and pass on the floor to Alexander.
So the topic of today's ECE research seminar is implications of COVID-19. As Vasily says, that's part of a broader research under the special research program on COVID-19, financed by the Science Fund of the Republic of Serbia. I have a joint work with two team members, Milojko Arsic and Emilija Maksimović. And the plan for today's seminar is to talk on COVID implications from two different angles. to tell something on the macroeconomic implications of fiscal stimulus, which is the core part of our project and our analysis. And the second topic is basically something we find interesting later on during our research. And the implications basically on health, but the idea is to discuss more reliable measuring of the country's success in dealing with COVID instead of official mortality rate. And finally, at the end, I plan to give you some main numbers or dynamics of the things going on in Serbia from both aspects, the macroeconomic one, and also to talk about mortality rates in Serbia. And first I will start with a study dealing with the effect of fiscal stimulus on economic activity and inflation. And just to remind you that at the very beginning of the pandemic, countries around the world started to implement very strict epidemiological measures, and as a result, we have a very immediate and sharp decline in economic activity. Very early also, in the second quarter of 2020, countries started to implement fiscal stimuluses of the magnitude which is unprecedented in recent history, and those measures were associated with expansive monetary policy, and as a result, economic activity started to recover very quickly since the second quarter of 2020, but in the next pandemic year, from the second quarter of 2021, there has been an increase in inflation worldwide. And as I said, the core analysis of our analysis of macroeconomic effects is basically a paper dealing with measuring the effect of fiscal stimuluses on economic activity and inflation. And the analysis is based on 25 European economies, so we have two pandemic years, eight quarterly data, and the main challenge in our research was to try to isolate discretionary fiscal policy measures, so to identify fiscal shocks in data. And as I said, that is the main research, and after that we conducted some additional analysis, some robustness check based on the same sample but for the longer period that starts from 2000 with specific treatment of the pandemic period, and the second robustness check basically is the use of monthly data for two pandemic years, but we have a broader sample of 75 world economies. And just very briefly, there are some very well-known theories on the effects of fiscal stimuluses on economic activity and inflation. They start from different assumptions, and as a result, they predict different effects on GDP and inflation. On the empirical side of previous research, there are also varying conclusions. But it is very well known that those fiscal multipliers are higher in the period of recession. Then the spending composition also is important. The multipliers are higher in the case of public investments. Then when monetary policy is expansive in the larger countries, in the countries with fixed exchange rate policy. Similar with effects on inflation, varying conclusions, depending if fiscal measures are supported with monetary measures, if there are some constraints on the supply side, and so on. And what is specific of fiscal stimulus is during the pandemic, as I said, the size of the intervention is historically on historical maximum. They were associated and applied with extremely expansive monetary policy, which was the characteristics not just of the pandemic, but also pre-pandemic period. And on the other side, those effects of fiscal stimulus might be a bit reduced due to the epidemiological restrictions, especially in the first year of pandemic. And just to get the idea on the size of the fiscal measures, we basically analyze the dynamics of fiscal deficit and public debt in relation to GDP for a longer period. It starts from 2001. And you can see that there is a higher fiscal deficit and also faster growth during the pandemic period, even compared with the great financial crisis from 2009. And the same applies to the set of advanced economies and also emerging markets and developing economies. Both those measures, deficit and debt, are endogenous in relation to GDP, and in order to somehow exclude the effect of a fall in GDP in the same period, we also follow the dynamics of the cyclically adjusted fiscal deficit, and also find it to be higher during the crisis compared to the increase during the 2009 financial crisis. And the same pattern we also have in the emerging markets and middle income economies, although we don't have a data on cyclically adjusted deficit for the previous period. And again, the important, let's say, the important would be to just mention the total stimuluses in 2020-2021 is estimated as roughly 10.2% of all GDP in 2020, which is a really huge level of the fiscal interventions during the pandemic. And on the dynamics of economic activity and inflation, again, if we analyze dynamics for a longer period, we see that in 2020, economic activity shows the biggest decline since the Second World War, and the same stands again for the group of advanced and developing economies. And the specific of the COVID period is that the fall in GDP has been registered around the world, on the contrary to the financial crisis which hit Europe and America. But also the recovery of the economy also was quite quick due to the fact that the drop is not a consequence of the internal weaknesses of the economy. In 2021, the levels of inflation were also the highest in both group of countries, so in developed and developing economies as well. And that was the motivation to conduct an econometric analysis. We, as I said, in the core part of the analysis, used the quarterly data for 2020-2021, and the dependent variable is economic activity, so GDP growth, and the explanatory variable of interest is basically this part here, discretionary fiscal policy indicator, and we use three alternative approaches in order to identify, to isolate that discretionary fiscal policy part. We started from real government expenditure data, since the change in government expenditure are predominantly the result of discretionary fiscal policy measures, while changes in government revenues are mostly the result of the automatic adjustment. And the first approach is basically based on econometric idea to use pre-pandemic data country by country that starts from 2000 to 2019, to use quarterly data in order to estimate the dynamics of the real government expenditures, and then to predict data for 2020-2021, so what would be the movement, the dynamics, if there was no COVID. And the difference between the predicted data and the actual data is the first measure that we use as a discretionary fiscal policy.
Can I ask a question? Which are you with the expenditures mainly of this? Is this the value of the fiscal budget or other services?
Just expenditures. So we use linear modeling to estimate dynamics and then predict for two.
I mean, we use expenditures or expenditures divided basically?
No, just real government expenditures, data, quarterly data, and then the difference is treated as the.
Can I just ask you that as well? I think it was the IMF which was producing data of COVID-associated fiscal expenditures. That is, you're not looking at that specifically. You're looking at all fiscal expenditures.
Okay.
You're not taking that specifically identified component from the IMF source.
Yeah. Yes, that's the case. Because we have a different analysis based on the data that includes fiscal deficits.
Okay.
But that is the idea here is to try to do it like in more detailed manner, like yeah, just discretionary part, like a shock in data.
So it's anything. It's not what the IMF specifically started identifying as COVID-induced.
No, it's, yeah. The definition of shock in our data is just the difference between what would happen if there was no COVID and that's the first idea or the first measure. And there is another one. We basically use the country-specific regressions for the, let's say, controlling time trend, the lagged value of real government expenditures, output gap, and inflation, and what is left in residuals is treated as the discretionary fiscal policy indicator. So that is like the second alternative way of measuring it. And the third one is basically what we press good filtering. So we used this method in order to estimate the long-term trend in data and the difference between the actual data and long-term trend is treated as the third measure for the discretionary fiscal policy. So those are three alternative measures, and we have a set of controls. The first one is specific for the pandemic period, so Sweden's index of epidemiological measures, which is basically a composite index of nine, I think, measures that refer to the lockdowns, where schools open and so on, and they create one general measure, overall measure of the how epidemiological measures were strict. And then we have a set of economic variables, and the last one is basically attempt to include monetary policy in the model. So those are controls, and basically we applied appropriate method of estimation for the shorter period, and a bit different when we start from 2000 to the 2021. And the main findings are here, some alternative specification in which I bolded the numbers that confirm positive and significant effects of those discretionary fiscal policy measures during the pandemic, and everything else is basically in line with the economic theory. So we find that, for example, faster economic growth in the pre-crisis has a positive impact, more developed economies has a greater decline in GDP, share of agriculture and share of services in GDP also matters, and at the end, as expected, more restrictive epidemiological measures had a negative impact on the economic activity. And and then we, as I said, we conducted three additional analyses in order to check our findings. The first one is the same specification, but we use a longer period from the start from 2000, and then include interaction dummy for the two pandemic years here. The second one is the one based on monthly data, and on the negative side we have a different but much more inferior and limited set of controls, and we use the fiscal data without isolating the automatic adjustments, so a bit different measuring for fiscal stimulus. But on the plus side, we were able to include 75 countries around the world. And the third part is something that we are still working on, local projections, as the attempt to estimate multipliers by using a single equation as proposed in Jordan's paper.
So the first one is equivalent, basically equivalent to difference in difference estimation.
No, it's the panel, it's traditional panel, the same one as previous, but the method of estimation is a bit different. But we basically included the interaction dummy of fiscal discretionary fiscal policy measures and dummy for these 2 years in order to specifically treat the pandemic period. But it's estimated for longer. So, yeah. But it's not basic difference in difference, but similar, yes. And those are the findings for the longer period. Again, those bolded digits are the positive and significant influence of alternative discretionary fiscal policy measures during the period of pandemic. And as I said, we conducted a similar analysis based on monthly data, but we used different measures for economic activity, the one on monthly frequencies. So industrial production for European economies and manufacturing industry for the world economies. And a bit different explanatory variables for fiscal stimulus, so economic export index, that takes values from 0 to 100, and income support and debt relief that takes value 0, 1, or 2, and similar set of controls. And again, the positive and significant effect is also confirmed on this alternative, let's say, measures for the fiscal intervention. The interventions, the same stands for the set of European countries as well as for the world economies of 75 of them. Some other controls include, additional controls included in model might have a bit different significance, and they have a different influence on the economic activity, but basically the effect of fiscal measures is confirmed. And the same, very similar, basically, analysis has been conducted based on in effects on inflation. And as I mentioned, that inflation started to increase in the second quarter of 2021. And the dominant perception of central banks, governments, economists is that the inflation is a result of disruptions in supply chains. And as I said, the effect of fiscal stimulus is on economic activities, something that you would expect from the economic theory, but the effect on inflation is a bit different finding than a result during the financial crisis. So we find a positive and significant effect in the two pandemic years, so we use the same set of the different, basically, quarterly inflation rate as dependent variables, same three alternative measures for discretionary fiscal policy, and some different control variables, and again, the positive and significant impact of all three alternative based measures. The discretionary fiscal policy has been confirmed. Besides that, as expected, we find that the depreciation of the national currency increases inflation, the increase in import prices, and more expansive monetary policy during the second year of pandemic. And as I said, we conducted the same similar analysis for a longer period on inflation, and also the one based on monthly data, and we confirmed the positive effects of fiscal stimulus is on inflation. So, as I said, on policy implications, we find that fiscal measures can help in mitigating the decline in economic activity, encourage the faster recovery, but there is an increase in inflation, and basically that is a bit different findings more in line with neoclassical theory and different than the one during the great financial crisis. And also those combination of those two policy measures is not a universal solution, so it should be accompanied with some additional measures in order to prevent problems on the supply side. And now something on the health consequences of COVID-19. Basically, we started with...
Can I interrupt you? And I don't know if you know, we should have like two mini seminars, but I have a few questions I would like to ask, and maybe other people may want to ask some things on the, specifically on the things that you presented. So let me ask, especially on the last point that you were saying about sort of the inflation effect. Of course, inflation also didn't kick in immediately because you still had closed economies, well, not closed economies as trade, but restricted economies. So even if you had money, so the initial effect was to create savings rather than demand of the fiscal stimulus. Or people were saving money because they wouldn't spend the money they were having. So that what came after the relaxation of the measures was that the demand that was coming from accumulated savings, and some of it was from the stimulus, some of it was not from the stimulus. So, people who stopped commuting to IKEA, like something here to central London, they were saving something like, £15 a day, £20 a day after tax. Easily, maybe 40 pounds a day. So then 2 years later you have a lot of money, and the problem that it wasn't that there was too much demand, but it was that the supply was slow and to catch up, exactly because of what you said. Is there a way, obviously I don't think you've done it in the regressions and how do you do it, but is there a way to try to separate that thing to see, how, like, should you control for savings, and or should you somehow try to do a two states where the stimulus affects somehow savings, and then IV the savings or something like that? How would you go about in trying to think, there's probably a savings effect here which affects inflation more than a direct stimulus in the traditional sense, mm-hmm. when the government spends and prices go up?
So, we haven't done that, but maybe the good idea was what would be to do it in two steps, to estimate.
Okay,
can I come back to the question which I asked earlier? One of the things that I had looked at, admittedly a year or so ago last, was this data that was very specifically COVID response expenditures mm-hmm. that the IMF was charting mm-hmm. and tabling, and I don't know if they are still doing it because I used it a year and a half ago maybe, and I haven't looked at it since. But when we're talking about this was mainly fiscal measures, but it was also monetary measures, I think that they counted there. Were you, or is it legitimate or interesting to actually take those as a specific component of expansion separate from other expansion? Do they constitute all the expansion? Do they actually constitute more than all the expansion? Mm-hmm. And is that in itself a variable that is worth examining? And you haven't done so yet, but would it be something which you could contemplate doing? Because it seems to me that you could include it into the model as part of your list of general controls. Yeah. You've got a lot of controls in there, and that seems to be a legitimate control to look at, for which, as far as I know, the IMF data set was, at least at that time, pretty complete.
Yeah, Yeah. We tried something like that, but there was no data on countries that we included in our analysis for all countries. They do that just for the, I don't know, European countries?
No, it's much bigger than that, because the stuff which... The stuff which I indeed used for something was a hell of a lot bigger than the European data. I mean, I can talk to you about that, because, I mean, this is something which is intriguing. I always wanted to follow up what I had done, but never got round to doing it. But that data was sitting there. Yeah.
Okay, great. If you have, that would be perfect.
Great.
Ben, in the first paragraph, you say that the fiscal and monetary expansion results are consistent with Keynesian and New Keynesian theories. In the second paragraph, you say the fiscal and monetary expansion results are consistent with neoclassical theory. How can the same thing be consistent with both Keynesian and neoclassical theory at the same time?
Well, the effect on inflation is not in line with.
Why not?
Well, it's not. Fiscal stimulus is not necessarily increased inflation during the end. Effect of fiscal on economic activity is something that you would expect.
I thought Keynesian theory would have accepted increased inflation, at least it used to be when I was young. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
That was how I was taught it.
Okay, so you think it's...
I think it's consistent. I mean, I wouldn't sort of necessarily use the small lines in the and possibly as a predecessor to it as well. I just simply said yes, that is what we'd expect. Will is almost as old as me or older, easy thing to say.
Yeah, no, and I think the neoclassicals would say that the effect is a price effect bigger than the quantity effect.
Mm-hmm.
And Keynesians would say that the quantity effect is bigger than the price effect. Mm-hmm. But I don't think a Keynesian would say there is no price effect.
Yeah.
And only a very fanatic neoclassical would say there's no quantity effect whatsoever. So, what is the greater effect?
Yeah, so just to relax it, or maybe to skip this. Okay.
The small print, actually, the smaller. Can I also ask another question? A bit more technical? Because you kind of talked about as a fiscal. In the introduction, you were talking about fiscal multipliers,
yeah,
and how fiscal multipliers may be different,
mm-hmm,
in expansion, recession, when the supply side is off or not, and so forth. But then when you present the results, you say nothing about multipliers. Yeah, so, and I noticed that, of course, as would happen, that the different measures produce quite different coefficients.
Mm-hmm.
So similar significance and science, but not the same magnitude, of course,
right,
because the scale is different. But can you tell us something about fiscal multipliers? So, yes, the effect is positive, but how positive? Especially at the back of the discussion that we had about the Greek crisis and the fiscal multipliers and stuff. And then also on slide 22, the interaction term is positive, fine, but the level effect is not positive, it's negative significant.
Yes, but it's larger. So when you zoom up the Y level and one during the pandemic, then overall during the pandemic.
Oh, okay. So the overall during the pandemic is positive, but that means that before the pandemic, Keynesians were not right because fiscal expansion was reducing GDP.
Yeah, it's a negative for the period before. Yes.
But that's quite a strong. Are you saying that if you take the data up to 2019,
mm-hmm,
and you don't include the interactions because you have that,
mm-hmm,
you will find a negative multiplier?
Yes, that's the...
Yeah, not yet.
I know, but the idea was to show that when you sum them up, it's a positive during the recession, but it's a negative.
No, because I would expect a positive effect, which becomes even more positive with it. And here it's like, the interaction effect is very strong. Yeah, 10 times
magnitude. Yes,
yes. the pre-COVID effect is negative, which is a bit surprising to me.
Yeah.
This is for 72 countries, right?
No, that's just for the European countries, basically. No, I think it's just
EU.
The EU countries.
I mean, I don't know, maybe like the majority of the period is a bit of austerity, so the fiscal expansion is negative.
You can't say that because you have to take the marginal effects, don't you? Because you've got CA
government expenditure and then the interaction.
So you have to look at both of them. You can't just take CA.
Yeah, but if you take the marginal effect in 2005, the marginal effect in 2005 is in the first column -0.1. Because the dummy in 2005 takes the value of 0.
Yeah.
So the fixed value for 2005 is a negative. Yeah. So I think maybe because of austerity, because of course we had fiscal consolidation, so not expansion, and the economy was improving because it was at the back of the crisis, so we reduced budgets. Maybe that's it, but otherwise I think it's a bit. I would be careful how I'm presenting this because you cannot say, okay, you know, during COVID everything was canceled.
Do you think with the COVID,
but before that, nothing was canceled?
Do you think there should be a dummy for the crisis?
It starts from 2000, so the whole period is kind of. I don't know. Maybe there should be a dummy for the crisis to see if in the 2000s the coefficient becomes positive. All I'm saying is. I found this very surprising that the effect throughout the period, which was okay, crisis, but also including normal years. And in some countries it was good years, even for, you know, Greece had the crisis, but not but you would expect that fiscal expansion would have a negative effect on GDP.
So that's, it's strange.
I would agree. I think Vasilis has got a point, and I certainly think that dividing the data up and using it, is going to. There is half of those were expansion years, approximately, and half of them were bad years in that sense. So possibly yes.
But then you have a time right as well.
So why do you like?
Just the dynamics, that's the first one, which will be rotated from the previous.
It's a good morale.
But maybe was it the purpose of this to sort of estimate how it was before to compare it with now?
Just to stress that the effect was very strong and positive during the pandemic. But
That's clear.
Maybe the best way would be to apply linear projection. I mean, they do include, there is a possibility to treat recession.
All I'm saying is that if you were presenting something that said that, I don't know, the sale of services reduces your GDP, and if the sale of agriculture increases your GDP, I would still ask you why, you know, like that goes against my experience, why do you think you find this? So likewise here, one of the findings is that, you know, before COVID, fiscal expansion was creating recessions, contemporaneously, which is very difficult to understand. Yeah, if you say that 5 years later there's a recession because you over-indebted yourself, then... I was just saying, like, you know, okay, try to explore this a bit better, to see where the negative thing comes from. It could be some austerity, it could be some party heterogeneity, it could be the time lag, and maybe have some sort of inverse causality here, but, you know, if your GDP falls, then your fiscal budget deteriorates. You know, because it's contemporary, so it may be different if you put 1 year lag or 2 year lag. Just explore it to see where it comes.
We basically included the periods of recession and So on average,
yeah, exactly. That's what it is. Yeah. But I mean, what you went from was a sort of period of still austerity to a period of very big generosity, didn't you? So I mean, that's why you're getting the very
small
large numbers.
Negative,
and then a very big number. Okay.
Yeah, I think that's
good. Shall we move to the follow-up paper?
That's what we came for.
That was a taste of to get you going. Alexander.
And as I said, the second paper is analyzing the health consequences of COVID-19 and the most common measure for the country's success in fighting pandemic was the official mortality rate from COVID-19, but later on the excess mortality rate is introduced as an increase in the number of deaths during the pandemic compared to the expected number, so to the average of the previous 10 years, I think. And we analyzed the two-year country's results in terms of mortality from COVID-19, and we find huge differences among countries, but also some different driving factors of those two official and excess mortality rates. And we analyzed 70 countries, and we find that less democratic countries' advantage in fighting the pandemic only exists when we are analyzing official COVID mortality data. The story is a bit different when we are analyzing excess of mortality. And
the UK, the democratic countries, or the...
No, Serbia, I must say, at the end, is a leader in those the differences in those two mortality rates, basically. One of the leaders. And if you take a look at the official COVID mortality rates of cumulative measures at the end of 2021, there are huge differences. So minimum value for 0.97 for New Zealand, I think, and the maximum value of over 600 for Peru. Huge standard deviation, and similar if we analyze excess mortality rates. So it varies from minus 50.2 again New Zealand for nearly 900 in Bulgaria. Also huge standard deviation. Ratio of these two, so excess and official COVID mortality rate is 1.65 on average, but standard deviation is 70.5.
Sorry, could you say again who was minus 50.2?
New Zealand.
You just shock people out there.
So here is the plot of official and excess mortality rates for, as I said, more than 70 countries. So positive correlation, but a huge dispersion of data. And again, on average, correlation is 0.8, but ranges from minus 0.7 New Zealand and 0.99 in Colombia.
What's the frequency of the data?
Sorry?
What's the frequency of the data?
We use monthly data and then cumulative values by the end of 2021. So, for example, for the February is the sum of everything happens until the February, and then you add the people died in March and so on.
Is it the flow or the cumulative measure?
A cumulative measure, but monthly data.
Yes.
And
yeah,
this one is reported for the last month, so end of 2021. But
it's only 2021. What is it also
2021, but the cumulative up to the last month of 2021. And basically, we first try to identify determinants of the official mortality rate, then the excess mortality rate, and specifically to analyze the differences between excess mortality and official numbers, and try to explain are those differences consequence of the underdevelopment of healthcare system, or to some point consequence of the manipulation of the official COVID mortality data in less democratic countries, what we are basically find later on. And all determinants of mortality be grouped as the quality of the healthcare system, so some of the very well known measures, the population characteristics, median age, collectivism, population density, and education, and finally some measures for the or different policies implemented during the pandemic, strictness of the epidemiological measures, additional spending on public health, and the vaccination rate. And those differences be potentially explained by the degree of democracy and media freedom in the country. So we find that autocracies with weaker institutions and stronger government control of the media are more likely to underreport official COVID mortality rate. And the excess mortality rate is more difficult to forge, and also it's not in the focus of the public attention during the pandemic was going on. And the difference in ability to identify cause of death, so there are different, I'd say, definitions of what is COVID as death directly or not. And that is due to the healthcare differences in the healthcare system, but the measures in error measures in measuring official COVID mortality rate is basically not the issue if you take the ratio of these two, so it's not important. And we had 72 countries in the sample and three different mortality measures, the official one as dependent variable, the excess, and also the ratio of these two. And they are reported on a monthly basis, and as explanatory variables we have the index of stringency of epidemiological measures, vaccination rate, the average temperature in the capital city, and also some variables which do not vary by time, just by country. These are the performance of the healthcare system, the economy, the population, and the political system, included as the quality of institutions, liberal democracy index, and world press freedom index in our analysis. And basically, we estimated the panel specification. And for the quality of institution by the World Bank, we use the composite index or linear combination of six indicators proposed by the World Bank, such as rule of law, control of corruptions, political stability, and so on. So we created one general indicator of quality of governance, meaning that high value represents the higher quality of institution.
The World Bank is also their own aggregate index of the quality of institution.
Well, basically, we created a principal component of these six to give a different login. But it's similar as the general.
And the results are similar.
Yes. Yeah, they are similar. Because they all have positive loads and capture of 86% of overall variations. And so on the official COVID mortality rate, we find some of the factors in line with theoretical expectations, such as the vaccination rate in the previous month lowers the official COVID mortality rate. Also, it's lower if the institutions were of the higher quality, the average temperature in the country or the capital city is higher, and the younger population is. But we find something unexpected. later on that, for example, more rigid epidemiological measures were applied, the mortality, official COVID mortality rate was higher, and also higher in the countries with better healthcare system before the pandemics, and higher if the additional investment during the pandemic was higher. And we also find that official mortality rate was lower in countries with a lower level of democracy. So that was a bit strange. And
can I say something? So, not sticking to the slightest way, but yeah. But so, I mean, the health system or the people who monitor COVID, like the government, know about deaths around 28 days before the deaths happen. Yeah, because they have, you know, kind of a real-time measure of infections, maybe 28 days, maybe 40, whatever. So if you use monthly data, they may implement restrictions. The restrictions will be in place by the time that people die. And in your regression, you'll find the causality to go, like, you know, that when the measures go up, people die. But the measures went up because we knew that it's like the umbrella example. You know, like every time I take my umbrella out, it rains. But it's because I saw the news and it said it would rain. So the measures were more stringent because we knew that people were dying. And then when people died, the measures were more stringent. But it's not the measures that killed the people. It was So maybe that, I mean, also again, it's a matter of, like, you know, finding different windows of time lag.
We tried to lag them for one or two periods, so
and
one or two, and
still
the same time.
Okay. I'm a bit concerned about some of these, which do look, I mean, the epidemiological measures, the vaccinations, seem to be highly endogenous. I mean, from what I have done, I mean, one of the things that I found was, you know, kind of, there was a good correlation between the number of vaccinations and the number of deaths, because, you know, kind of, if there were lots of deaths, then people started to vaccinate, or if there were lots of deaths, people started to slap down control measures. So, in the work, I mean, which I'm not going to talk about here, in the work, I was trying to take all of these factors, which were potentially, and I was trying to take their ex post situation, the status, and I only looked at those. So if I was interested in the development of healthcare, I was looking at what the state of the world was like, you know, so that by 2019 or at 2019, and not what happened afterwards, a lot of which was a response. And therefore, you know, sort of all what people's, I wasn't looking at people's vaccination rates, but I was looking at whether people were interested in being vaccinated at all or resistant to being vaccinated. Was that a problem rather than how many people? I mean, France was a classic case where France, on my measures, you know, France was right up the top in being anti-vax in 2019. But subsequently, France actually ended up with a very high vaccination rate when you got to the end, halfway through. So, it's the endogeneity of these which does what it hit a lot.
I mean, I cannot get my head around the fact they're using cumulative things. So the you don't have some sort of trend in the right hand side, do you? Time trend. Do you have a time trend?
No.
So then the cumulative is like, you know, like, take temperature. Your temperature goes up. It's hot, and then you know, but it's March, and you think, okay, higher temperature, more deaths. Then the next month, you know, deaths will only go up because it's cumulative. So even if at a declining rate, you know, 100 people died this month, 80 people died next month, you still observe an increase. So you would, you know, to get a positive estimate, temperature will have to go up. Yeah, but that doesn't go.
But are we talking, are we talking here about hot countries versus cold countries, or are we talking about monthly temperature? In other words, what happens in, let's say, European countries in the summer as opposed to in the winter, or in southern hemisphere countries, vice versa?
No, it's a monthly level.
And then you have country fixed effects.
Basically, no, because those variables like population, healthcare system, which do not vary. So I use them in order to incorporate country fixed effects. Those variables that does not vary by time, just the country. And that's something previous we find in some similar research in order to deal with varying monthly and...
Yeah, I just don't know. I mean, you know, if you told me that there was no annual variables and no country variables, no country variations, they kind of quality of government and so forth, and you were just doing monthly variables on the right-hand side, it's multiple, I would say, why on earth you use the cumulative? You should just use the flow on the left-hand side.
Yeah.
Because there's flows on the right-hand side, there's no... So I don't get, unless you had some sort of time trend, that you thought, okay, there's a natural accumulation of deaths, and everything I run is a deviation from the time trend, from that trend.
Okay.
But otherwise, it would be very bizarre how you would expect, flow variables on the right-hand side to explain a cumulative variable on the left-hand side. Now, you kind of complicate that by having a panel, of course, with some of the country-level variables absorbing the fixed effect as well, and also having annual variables, which are kind of de facto cumulative, because the GDP of the year is the accumulation of the money day after day, so it's cumulative. So maybe that's okay, but I don't know, I'm a bit confused, I don't know. But it seems a bit odd, especially when you interpret the monthly frequency variables, the elasticity, suppose, it seems a bit odd how you would sort of, translate that into a cumulative effect. When the temperature in the heart as it increases, the cumulative effect goes down.
Monthly data just without...
Yes. I mean, I actually, given what you're trying to do, I think that is what you should be doing. I mean, what you were doing is something different from what I was doing, where I was able to work with sort of stocks cumulative data at certain points. But I think Vasilis is right that there is this sort of peculiar mixture going on here of flow. There was a lot of work that was done, you must have read it as well, because I had to read lots of it, which was actually sort of on transmissions, which was looking in it. So these were studies which were based upon flow statistics over certain periods, and they did do that. So it's certainly possible to do, and certainly people have done it. And this mixture is slightly makes me slightly unhappy.
And you could also, you're not really interested in the average temperature. Yes, it's not your policy variable.
Yeah.
So you may just aggregate the data and say in 2020 X number of people died, 2021 Z number of people died. I have a panel with 2 years and I want to see how variations are here. There's no variation from year to year.
So just to have two time points, I mean,
two annual. I mean, at least in addition to, so get a monthly version of it, get an annual version of it, you'll have different variables in because. I don't know, because the average temperature will be a fixed effect in the annual thing. And maybe play, I don't know.
But lots of data were lagging behind COVID, and they were not reported in time, or were reported lately, and lots of measures were affecting them with a time lag. If they're looking at monthly data, you will not be able to reflect that. From the right-hand side to the left-hand side.
Yeah, but you would retrospectively. I mean, the point was that I'm taking it, are you using the Johns Hopkins data set.
Yes.
I mean, that did get revised at various times, but if you are looking at, I mean, here we are at the beginning of 2023, and you're looking at, 20 and 21, that data is, at least for that period, is as clean as it's ever going to be.
They're not going to change it.
Yes, exactly. I mean, they put a stop on to it, I mean, relatively recently, as I saw. So the problems of people not reporting, and it is true that, I mean, if you look at the, if you compare the sort of early stuff that was published and then the revised early stuff, your problem is apparent, that I think it got sort of cleaned out later on. And then now it's problematic for all kinds of other reasons, but at the period that you're covering, it sounds like,
okay, let's close it.
And so on the determinants of excess mortality rate, we find everything else to be in line with theoretical expectations, and we also find that higher level of democracy results in the lower excess rate. So we were focused on the differences of these two and trying to explain, are they due to the due to the different definitions of cause of that, I mean the quality of the healthcare system, and due to the data manipulation by governments. And we find that that ratio, the relative difference between the excess and the official mortality, is greater in the countries with weaker institutions, lower degree of democracy, lower degree of press freedom, and smaller in more developed countries. The idea is to use excess of mortality as a better measure in order to compare success in fighting COVID between countries than to use the official COVID mortality rate. And something on what's going on in Serbia during the pandemics was the policy responses in terms of epidemiological restrictions. So Serbia has a very strict epidemiological restriction at the beginning until the May of 2020. Actually, we had elections in June 2020 and then relaxed everything just before that. And since then, the restrictions were relatively mild, and in practice, the violation of those rules was tolerated. Also, we have a very poor campaign for vaccination, although we have vaccines available very early. And the vaccination rate is also very low in Serbia. On the economic measures, we have from May 2020 until the end of 2022, a very strong non-discriminatory fiscal stimuluses. And as you can see here, compared to the average for the Western Balkan or Central and Eastern European economies, we have fiscal stimuluses roughly above the 12% during the pandemic period, so the red line. And the fiscal deficit in 2022 was around 4%, and it's planned to be 3% for the next 2023. On the monetary policy measures, at the beginning of 2020, National Bank of Serbia reduced the reference interest rate to 1%, and after that, from April 2022 to January 2023, the reference rate is increased to 5.25, from April to January this year. And in terms of macroeconomic indicators, before the pandemic, Serbia has a higher growth rate than the EU and Central and Eastern European average, as a result of 2020, we have a smaller decline and above average recovery in 2021. In 2022, the growth rate of the economic activity was slower than EU and Central and Eastern European average. And on inflation, so in 2021, the inflation rate was slightly higher than in EU and CEE, and was also, and again, in 2023 is expected to be lower than in 2022. It's interesting that the ratio of debt to GDP also increased from 52% to 55%, even though the public debt in euros increased around 35% since the pre-pandemic 2019. Due to the inflation and GDP growth on one side and on government borrowing in euros and the fixed exchange rate on the other side. So that's the possible explanation. And on the health outcomes, so if we take into analysis official cumulative mortality rate from COVID, so the Serbian blue line is dealing better than the EU and Central and Eastern European economies, but it's a completely different picture when we analyze the excess of mortality rates, and the difference between these two is among the highest in the world. In Serbia, so there are some indicators of data manipulation with official numbers in our country. And I think that's the last one.
Thank you, Alexandra. Actually, a lot of material, a lot of interesting material, and quite diverse also. You know, you can talk about different IOP as well as kind of quality of institutions and stuff. So, very nice. We will continue the conversation in the same spirit, so feel free to chip in on this.
Two things. I ended up not working with excess deaths, but only with recorded deaths. It was only relatively recently, as far as I recall, that I'm not quite sure whether it was in JAMA or something, or maybe it was in The Lancet, because I kept on reviewing papers on this, that somebody actually started trying to use excess deaths as opposed to official deaths. I mean, and one of the reasons in a lot of this was that actually people were much more skeptical about the excess deaths and how the excess deaths were being calculated relative to the official deaths, which in a sense were an easier thing to actually get to understand, where excess deaths is a considerably more complicated exercise, and I can find all kinds of reasons why I might be very skeptical about excess deaths. That's simply an issue which I throw back to you, because I mean, I left it alone, and I'm interested that you've actually tried to look at relationships, which I think is an interesting story in its own right. The thing I wanted to bring up, which relates to a lot of this, and I mean, the Serbian example merely gave a kind of case in point, is the whole question, and it comes back to the time series and the sort of thing which we were talking about earlier, which is the issue of, between inverted commas, fatigue, which was interesting because two or three slides back there, you actually showed the strictness, for instance, of Serbia's epidemiological restrictions. But then, you know, sort of a line or two later, you actually said, well, actually, but nobody paid very much attention to them in any case. People's attitudes, people's behavioural attitudes, quite apart from the formal restrictions, were likely to be influenced by fatigue in any case. And this fatigue component seems to be an important thing which we ought to take into account. I mean, the sort of thing that I was looking at was, I was interested in these measures of sort of trust in government and the way in trust in health services, mm-hmm. and the extent to which these changed over a relatively short time period. It didn't change everywhere, and I have not got, you know, sort of consistent data over lots of countries, but I've got a number of indicators of where it did happen and where it didn't seem to happen, and that was very important. I don't know quite where one is, how one builds this into what one was modelling earlier, but it seems to be something which, you know, if one's looking over what was happening during and what kind of, it was not only what kind of policies were there, but how were people actually reacting to those policies? Because as you said yourself, you can have very strict ones, nothing happens, and you can have very light ones, but quite a lot happens. So, I mean, I had lots of discussions with people in Sweden about what they were doing and or not doing. And there was a lot of debate, and people got very angry with one another in Sweden about this, if nowhere else, just about what they were doing. Mm-hmm. But in those, on that basis, yeah. Those are more observations than questions.
Very long observation. Alexander, would you like to respond? I would like to, so, you know, I have to offer you a different thing about the use, a different view on the use of the excess versus the official death. Something, the official death is, which is also like a question I have for you, is, you know, here in the presentation you said, okay, you know, undemocratic governments or populist governments, whatever, they want to manipulate the data, but actually there's no perfect measure of, you know, official measure of COVID deaths. So countries were trying to do whatever they were trying to do. Yes, so the UK, I don't know about other countries, but I'm sure there's variations. The UK initially was like, you know, once you have COVID, whenever you die, it's a COVID death. Even if you hit by a car, it's still a COVID death. And then they stopped that and they said, if you die within 28 days, yeah, from COVID, from testing positive. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's many people, especially in intensive care, that were kept alive for more than 28 days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when they died on the 29th day, it was not, you know, you die in intensive care with COVID,
mm-hmm.
and you don't count as a COVID death because it's after 28 days. So, I mean, obviously, in the examples I gave, mm-hmm. both measures are stupid. You know, if you hit by a car, why is it a COVID death? If you die in intensive care, why is it not a COVID death? Mm-hmm. Which shows, however, that, you know, it's not just a, you know, Woods is wanting to manipulate the data to win the elections or whatever. It's like, you know, what is the best measure? I don't know.
Yeah, well, as a statistician, I'm in the COVID, and I know we have more of us here. For us, it was excess death. That was the right the right indicator without zero doubt.
I mean,
so,
no measure is it's
very
less simple. Problematic.
It's
yeah.
Clearly.
Yeah.
For official rate or excess death.
The probability of that time series was like 140 million.
Yeah,
something
like that.
That
really happened.
Yeah,
yes.
So one only has to look at what was sort of going on in China in the last month, seemed to actually sort of, I mean, which takes this, you know, sort of to extremes. All of a sudden things are not reported at all. And then, you know, sort of, but then last week there she started reporting things again.
That's cumulative, right?
Yeah.
That's why, yeah. Makes sense to me.
So yeah, it makes it. But I mean, I'm interested that you actually say that you think excess deaths are better in a particular case. I mean, but are you saying
in general, in statistics? I was here during COVID crisis, and when I was doing myself, you know, obviously I was concerned, citizen as any other. But then, of course, I was going to use my, you know, my tools that I have to sort of, you know, explain the situation. So yeah, that's it. It's very simple.
Just as the other problem, which is however less of a problem in my mind, that you know, you have of course more people dying with COVID. So you say, okay, you know, in the last 10 Januaries we had on average 20 deaths. This tunneling, we have 34 deaths. Okay, 4 are excess. We call it excess. We're not sure the COVID, but the, so the problem with that is that maybe, you know, like for example, with the lockdowns, nobody was driving. So you have fewer car accidents.
Yes, minus 15 in New Zealand.
So that, you know, but then on the other hand, if you think, okay, I'm not talking about the virus, but I'm talking about COVID, the effect of COVID was that fewer people died from car accidents.
Yeah.
So more lives were saved.
Yes, but then but that has some ridiculous implication that the more COVID we have, maybe the healthier we are, because we all sit inside and don't do anything. But if we're talking about COVID as opposed to, and we're talking about what things generate COVID deaths, then we should be interested in are not driving. This comes back to a data question, because if I am right, Johns Hopkins didn't start reporting excess deaths for quite a long time after they were reporting COVID deaths at all. Mm-hmm. So that series was newer. Mm-hmm. Who was actually producing that series?
New York Times
and Magadabib,
sorry.
They did. I'm not sure.
Because I mean, you know, kind of in a sense, you're the disease control center of your country, and you're reporting your COVID deaths, maybe assiduously. But are you actually at the same time calculating your excess deaths and feeding them back, or is somebody sitting in?
You don't even have official statistics,
exactly.
Because you know, you just download the data on deaths, and then you take current death minus average of past deaths.
Well, except you've got to do all the age adjustments and whatever and whatever. So I mean, it's not as those the proper excess deaths were, you know, sort of were adjusted. They're not.
Yeah.
And that was why it was quite a lot of work. That's why I'm saying, you know, kind of, I'm not quite certain how good your excess test might be. Very good because you did it properly, and your excess test might be less good because you simply did a subtraction.
But I mean, whatever the statistical niceties, this picture looks pretty shocking, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, maybe more or less, but and is the general public in Serbia aware of this, and is it having any political reaction?
Press freedom. It's not very. not a lot of people are aware.
So when you publish this, it will be a shock to the system.
I think there were some
four pages in the newspapers.
Well,
basically, the survey is just one of a country in a panel, and that specific graphs we produced just in order to illustrate, but it's maybe for the science world of the Republic of Serbia, we will just stop at the panel analysis without.
Can you go back to the panel results so that we can actually see the data on, or the coefficients on things like the press freedoms and now this is all incredibly difficult because it's a very small one, and at my age you can't be expected to see everything. And secondly, it's a whole lot of. Can you show us where the relevant things for the press freedoms and the democracies and
what?
No, the ones that I stress here. So the government of policy, these measures, then liberal democracy index and freedom of press index. So these.
So liberal democracy increases. Associated with more deaths.
Yes,
officially. More important deaths, but but less excess.
Yes, the point.
And that's the panel of 72 countries.
Yes.
And what's the difference between? No, okay, so Yeah, so GDP per capita level of development in 2019 is a bad thing in volume one, but a good thing if you, no, it's a good thing in volume one, but a bad thing if you account for liberal democracies.
Yes, but...
And then it disappears in volume four.
Yeah, we basically kept everything significant and tried to... some of these data are also, yeah, correlated and due to that fact you might find it.
You really only need to look at the last column. That's the thing about the ratio.
Okay, no, I mean, you know, the strongest result is that about kind of liberal democracy where there's one effect is positive, going two versus going four, because in the...
That's consistent, because the first one is the official rate.
Yes.
So in less democracy, less liberal democracies, it's lower. And in the excess mortality, the second column, it's higher. So that's perfectly consistent.
Can I ask how much of this is driven by China, which was an extraordinary outlier on quite a lot of those variables? I mean, the work that I was doing...
No China.
Because, I mean, I was doing things where I took China in and put China out just to see what happened.
And?
I mean, it's some interesting... It wasn't exactly this, but, I mean, it was in my case, but, I mean... I was still in the case where China was recording only about 3,000 COVID accumulated deaths or something, which it was until pretty recently. And it was terribly interesting there because China was sort of scoring incredibly low on deaths and incredibly high or low, depending on how you wanted to measure it, on some of those things about, you know, sort of authoritarian press controls and whatever. And did China make a difference? Now, I mean, in fact, it was interesting what they was doing, but, you know, because it didn't matter, China. Mm-hmm. But China's not in that data set.
Not in
that. Actually, why is China not there? Because, I mean, you're doing... Who are the 72 countries that got there? Did they get... They must have got there for some reason, because Johns Hopkins produces more than 72 countries worth of data, and some of those things about, you know, sort of governance and or democracy or press freedom, you know, we've got more than 72...
Maybe some of the data was not good. Maybe, you know, data on vaccination rates... Do they have monthly data on the vaccination rate? Or something was missing?
But things like press freedom. I mean, is that a monthly indicator that you've got?
No, that's
exactly.
What
that's what I mean. So those things there are, I don't know, pre, you know, sort of ex ante things like that, which are there and those are fixed. So. I mean, why, who is in there and who is not? See, this seems to be sort of, you know, I don't quite know who the 72 is. And one of my problems, which I was having all the time when I was sort of reading the JAMAs and the Lancets and the whatevers on this, is that people were taking, you know, kind of 150 plus countries sometimes. I mean, you know, so there was an enormous divergence in these countries in terms of what they were. Then they might or might not have had indicators. I mean, maybe they had those or they didn't have those. And so it doesn't seem to me, I can't quite understand why, you know, sort of why 72 and which 72.
I might have a list somewhere, but basically the data, we were able to get data from this.
Okay. I mean, you know, I'm sure in the paper there will be a list of
yes.
stuff here, so it's not the... okay.
But I'm sure that China is not, that's
for
sure.
We're running out of time, but if I can make a comment suggestion, I think bad thing about the monthly things, the monthly frequency and the cumulative nature of the is still bugs me.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be definitely useful, especially if the point of the paper is about sort of liberal democracy or you know, media freedom and stuff. These are things that are very standard measures. You know, you do the PCA, but actually you can say, okay, media freedom or freedom house reports, this is a autocracy, this is not autocracy. And then you just the scatter plots of the deaths, not on a monthly basis, but just say, you know, like in 2 points in time, December 2020, so a blue dot and a purple dot, whatever, and you do the scatter plot and you have, you know, sort of on one side the liberal democracy, you know, do they group? Because if they don't group, you know, like because they, you know, in order for these results to have any value, they should also visually group. There's nothing, you know, because you're not saying this is a very, you know, conditional correlation, so I really need the multiple regression. The argument is that, you know, in liberal democracies, results were manipulated. You're not saying, in liberal democracies, when average AIDS is X and when you know, the budget is that, then they are manipulated. You know what I mean? So it should also, you know, the scatter plot correlation should also tell the same story as the regression. You know? So it would be important to strengthen the credibility in that sense of the result, because otherwise people can start asking, why is this a cumulative measure? Why did you do? Why don't you have kind of fixed effects? Where, what happened with the, you know, whatever, all the different, you know. Why is the zip of the capital disappearing?
I think that is very wrong. I mean, and that kind of, as I said, I was doing it with sort of points in time and not looking at developments over time. And I think, you know, what Vasily says, particularly because we're talking about, you know, sort of what was the state of, you know, what was it like in your country? What was it like in your country? Was your country more or less like this, more or less like that? And are you more likely to do something than you're more than you are doing something? Would you want those to tell us about? So I think I would say with this, I would go back a bit and start on a somewhat more simple approach and try and look at that first before I get into the sort of degrees. And it comes back to also these things I was talking about fatigues and whatever, and, you know, sort of enforcements and non-enforcements, because, you know, one of the things you might take is that, you know, your country is actually very poor on enforcing whatever it says. That's an indicator of you. You're very good at doing this. You don't have to do very much, but you do it rather well. You say you do lots, but don't actually do anything about it. And I think if we could take some indicators like that, one might get rather nearer to the picture that you are trying to present. I sort of came here for the second half rather than the first half, so I was very interested in this, and if you're around, I would love to talk more. If you're not going home tomorrow or something like that, it would be very interesting to discuss this in more detail. I know it's 7:30 and that's what it's probably wanting to talk about.
It is 7:30 and the official excuse is that we shouldn't continue because then we impose on the staff of doing the support for the seminar. So, I repeat, thank you. Okay, we'll finish on that. Alexander, again, thank you very much for the presentation.